Hello and welcome back to the Deep Dive. It is great to have you with us.
Good to be here.
Today, we are going to try to visualize the invisible. We're looking at a system that you probably engaged with, what, 50 times before you even had your morning coffee?
Oh, probably more, honestly. If you checked your phone in bed, you're already in the triple digits.
Exactly. We are talking about the whole ecosystem of digital communications. And I know that sounds a bit dry.
It does, a little corporate.
It sounds like a seminar you'd get dragged to at work. But the research we have today, it suggests that this isn't just about cables and code. It's about, well, why your grandmother can't read the email you sent her.
Right.
Or why you want to throw your remote control through your smart TV screen when you're just trying to type in a password.
It's all about the friction points. That's really what we're analyzing today. We have a whole stack of notes here covering everything from software architecture to hardware limitations, network physics, and even human psychology.
Wow.
And the big takeaway from all of these sources is that effective communication is actually kind of a miracle. There are 1,000 places where the chain can break between your brain and mine.
So let's audit that chain. The sources break this down into, what, 4 distinct layers?
That's right.
Creation, which is the software, the vessel, which is the hardware, the connection, so the network, and finally, the human element.
And we should probably start with creation, because before a message goes anywhere, it has to exist. And this is where most people make their first mistake, choosing the wrong tool for the job.
I feel a little called out already. I'm definitely guilty of trying to force everything into, you know, a standard word processor.
Well, most people are, right. We just default to what we know. But the sources highlight this whole spectrum of document types that really require totally different engines.
Okay.
Take leaflets, for example. You'd think, small piece of paper, easy.
Right. It's just text on a folded page. I mean, how hard can it be?
But from a design perspective, the notes argue that leaflets are actually significantly harder to produce than a standard 10-page report.
Really? Why is that?
It's all about density and layout. In a report, you have the luxury of a linear flow, you know, top to bottom.
Sure.
In a leaflet, you have such limited real estate. You have folds that break up the text, and you have to grab attention instantly. If you try to do that in a standard word processor, you are going to spend 3 hours fighting with the margins.
Oh, I know that struggle so well. You move an image 1 millimeter to the left, and suddenly 3 pages of text just poof, disappear into the void.
Exactly. And that's because word processors are stream-oriented. They think in lines of text. For a leaflet or a newsletter, or certainly for something like a magazine, you need to move to desktop publishing, DTP.
The sources make a really big deal about this distinction. They talk about frames.
Yeah.
Can you break that down for us? Why is a frame such a game changer here?
Okay, so think of a word processor like a typewriter. The paper moves up, you type across, it's rigid. DTP is more like a collage or a whiteboard. You create a box that's a frame, and you pour your text into it. Then you create another frame for an image. You can drag these boxes anywhere you want on the page, and they don't disrupt the rest of the document.
And the sources mention text flow, which I thought was fascinating.
Right. Yeah, this is the killer feature. If you have too much text for one box, you can just link it to another box on, say, page 3. The text automatically flows from one to the other.
Oh, wow.
And if you delete a sentence on page 1, the text on page 3 just sucks back up to fill the gap. It completely separates the content from the layout.
So if you are making a simple report, you know, text, maybe a chart, linear reading, you should stick to the word processor.
For sure. It's built for spell check and grammar.
But if you're doing anything that requires design, you really need DTP.
Precisely. It also gives you all these other tools like rulers, grid lines, and snapping tools, so everything lines up perfectly. And you can view spreads, you know, seeing 2 pages side by side like an open book. It's all about using the tool that actually fits the structure of the information.
Now, speaking of structure, let's talk about databases, because this is another area where I think people get a little intimidated.
Yeah.
The sources define this as structured storage.
I like to think of it as a digital filing cabinet, but one that's actually smart. A lot of people try to use spreadsheets as databases.
I am 100% guilty of this. I love a good spreadsheet.
And don't get me wrong, spreadsheets are incredible engines for calculation. The sources highlight formulas as the real magic there. You change one number and the whole model just updates.
That what-if analysis.
Exactly. And you can generate charts dynamically.
Yeah.
But spreadsheets are just terrible at managing records.
So when do I actually need a database?
When you need to ask questions. The sources distinguish between forms and queries. A form is just a clean interface to put data in so you don't mess up the rows.
Okay.
But a query is how you get data out.
Can you give me a real-world example of that?
Sure. Imagine a school. If you have a spreadsheet with every student, every grade, and every teacher, it's just a huge mess. In a database, if you want to know which students in grade 10 have an allergy to peanuts, you just run a query.
And it just finds them.
It searches all that data and gives you exactly that list. Nothing more, nothing less.
So it's the difference between looking for a needle in a haystack and, I don't know, having a magnet that just pulls the needle right out for you.
That is a great analogy.
Yeah. Okay, one more document type before we move on. Infographics. Right. Everyone loves these on social media.
They do, and for good reason. They're visually engaging. The source notes that their main purpose is to make statistics and facts appealing. If you have a really dry data set, an infographic brings it to life. But, and this is the catch, it requires skill. You can't just throw numbers on a picture. It requires a real blend of graphic design and data analysis.
Got it. Okay, so we've created the content. We've used DTP for our newsletter, a database for our mailing list, or maybe a spreadsheet for our financial report. Now we need to actually display it. This brings us to the hardware.
Mm-hmm.
And the big insight here seems to be about input versus output.
It is. We often judge devices by their screens, their output. But the sources point out that the input method is often the real bottleneck for communication.
Let's look at the smart TV. I think this is the perfect example of that bottleneck.
It's a classic user interface nightmare. The screen is gorgeous 4K, huge high contrast, great for output.
Absolutely.
But the input device is a remote control with four directional arrows.
Which leads to that little dance we all do. Left, left, down, right, select, just to type the letter A.
And the source explicitly notes this. It says, it is difficult to enter text. It sounds obvious, but think about the implication. You would never try to reply to an email on your TV.
Never.
You wouldn't try to edit a document. It basically turns communication into a one-way street. You're a consumer, not a creator.
Whereas the desktop or laptop is the creator's hub.
Exactly. Keyboards and mice are still the champions of bandwidth for human-to-computer input. I mean, you can type 80 words a minute. You have precision clicking. The trade-off, as the notes mention, is portability and power. You're tethered. A desktop needs mains power. You can't just use it on the bus.
And then we have the device that tries to do it all, the smartphone.
The jack of all trades. It's highly portable. It's always connected via 4G, 5G, or Wi-Fi. Apps are super easy to download. But the source makes a really blunt assessment here. It says it's not suitable for certain types of use, such as desktop publishing.
It's a screen size issue, right?
Yeah, it is. But it's also an information density issue. You cannot view a spread. Those two facing pages of a magazine we talked about in DTP on a 5-inch screen, you just lose all the context.
Right.
So if you send a complex PDF designed for a desktop to someone who only views it on a phone, your communication has technically arrived, but functionally it's failed. They can't read it without pinching and zooming until they get dizzy.
That's a key insight. Delivery does not equal readability.
Exactly. And somewhere in the middle, you have tablets. Larger touch screens than phones, so they're better for viewing. But for serious typing, the notes say you often need to add an external keyboard.
There is one more specialized screen mentioned here, smart boards.
Ah, yes. The interactive whiteboard. You see these in classrooms and corporate training rooms. They are fantastic for collaboration because multiple people can touch the screen at once.
It turns the display into an input device.
Exactly. But obviously, they are expensive and you need a large empty wall. You aren't putting one in your backpack.
So let's talk about that delivery, the invisible infrastructure. We have our content, we have our device, but how does the data actually travel? We have wired and wireless. And I feel like for the last decade, we've been told wireless is the future, wires are dead. But the sources suggest wires are still the heavyweights.
Wires have physics on their side. Let's look at Ethernet. That cable you plug into the wall or the back of a router, it uses copper twisted pair cabling to cancel out electromagnetic interference. It just keeps the signal clean. Ethernet is cheap, it's robust, and it's fast. But its limitation is distance. The signal really degrades over copper. You usually need a boost, a switch, or a hub every 100 meters or so.
So that connects my computer to the wall.
Mm-hmm.
But what connects my city to the world?
Fiber optic. This is the gold standard. We aren't sending electricity over copper anymore. We are sending pulses of light down a tiny glass or plastic thread.
And since nothing is faster than the speed of light,
you get just massive bandwidth. And crucially, you can transmit over huge distances, we're talking miles and miles, without any signal loss. This is the backbone of the internet. It's what connects continents.
But we don't plug fiber cables into our phones. We rely on those invisible waves. We rely on Wi-Fi.
And this is where physics starts fighting back again. The source notes that Wi-Fi connects to a LAN via a wireless access point. But radio waves, they struggle with obstacles. Walls, metal, water.
Wait, water? You mean like people?
Yeah. We are mostly water. A crowded room can actually dampen a Wi-Fi signal. But the bigger issue the source highlights is bandwidth sharing.
Right, the pizza theory.
Exactly. If you have a gigabit connection coming into the house, that's a big pizza. But if 10 people are streaming 4K video, everyone gets a tiny little slice. The speed just drops. Wired connections don't suffer from this in the same way because they're usually dedicated lines to the switch.
Now, there's a wireless technology here that I want to challenge you on, Bluetooth. The notes say it's not very secure and slow. If it's so bad, why do we use it for everything from headphones to smartwatches?
Because it's incredibly efficient. Bluetooth isn't trying to be Wi-Fi. It's designed for personal area network spans.
Yep.
Short range, usually under 10 meters. Its superpower is low power consumption. If your headphones used Wi-Fi to connect to your phone, the battery would die in like 20 minutes. Bluetooth just sips energy.
So it's a trade-off. You give up speed and range, but you get battery life.
Exactly. You wouldn't send a huge video file over Bluetooth. It would take forever. But for sending a play command or a little heart rate data packet, it's perfect.
Then we have the big leap. Mobile networks. We've gone from 4G to 5G. And the source makes a really bold claim here. It says 5G is comparable to Ethernet and fiber speeds.
In ideal conditions, yes, it can be. And this really changes the paradigm. Historically, mobile always meant slower. 5G implies that the wireless connection in your pocket could actually be faster than the wired connection in your house.
And this connects to the IoT, the Internet of Things. Why is 5G so critical for that? Is it just the speed?
It's capacity and latency. Latency is the reaction time, the gap between clicking stop and, say, the car actually stopping. 4G had a bit of a lag. 5G is almost instant.
I see.
And if you are going to have autonomous cars or smart fridges or medical devices all talking to each other, you just can't have lag. 5G enables that whole mesh of devices to exist reliably.
Before we move to the final section, we should probably mention the distribution channels themselves. We have the pipe, the 5G, or the fiber. But how is the package actually delivered?
Well, the sources list a few key methods. The cloud is the big one, now storing files on the internet so you can get them anywhere, but you are reliant on the internet connection.
Of course.
Then there's email, the classic. The source mentioned tracking for email, which is interesting.
Knowing if someone opened it.
Yeah, it's standard for newsletters now, but it also highlights the spam filter problem. You can have the best connection in the world, but if the spam filter blocks you, communication fails. And for real-time stuff, we have VoIP, voice over internet protocol. That's your Zoom or your Teams calls.
Okay, so we have the pipe, we've built the style, we've sent it over 5G. Now we get to the final and probably most important layer, the recipient, the human element.
This is where the engineering meets the biology. You can have the fastest network in the world, but if the person at the other end can't process the information you've sent, you've failed.
The sources break this down by demographics. Let's talk about age.
It's fascinating how the requirements just flip. The notes suggest that for young children, you want simpler text and brighter colors. It's all about engagement and reducing cognitive load. They're learning to read, so the graphics need to do the heavy lifting.
And for older adults.
You might think it's the same, but it's not. They often want more text. They want the details. But the presentation has to change. You need larger print. And here's a really specific design constraint. High contrast.
Why is high contrast so important?
As our eyes age, the lens yellows slightly and becomes less flexible. Distinguishing between, say, light gray text on a white background becomes incredibly difficult. It just looks washed out. So stark black on white is an accessibility requirement, not just a style choice.
Speaking of accessibility, I'm so glad the sources elevate this from a nice to have to a mandatory requirement.
Oh, absolutely. The digital world is increasingly the only world for things like banking, healthcare, and news. If you lock people out, it's a massive social problem.
One specific tool mentioned is alt text for visual impairments. Could you explain how that works for the listener?
So a screen reader is a piece of software that reads a web page out loud to a blind user. When it hits a paragraph, it reads the words. Simple. But when it hits an image, it has no idea what it is.
It would just say image file or something.
Exactly. It might just say image543.jpg, which is useless.
Worse than useless, it's confusing.
Right. Alt text is a hidden description, you, the creator, attached to the image. So instead of the file name, the screen reader says, a bar chart showing a 50% increase in sales from last quarter It translates the visual into the verbal.
And for hearing impairments, it's all about captioning.
Right. And this is a great example of what they call the curb cut effect.
The what?
The curb cut effect, you know, the little ramps on sidewalks? They were designed for people in wheelchairs, but who uses them? Parents with strollers, travelers with suitcases, skateboarders.
Everyone.
Everyone. Closed captions are the same. They're absolutely essential for the deaf, but millions of people use them just because they're watching a video on the bus with the sound off. Accessibility helps everyone.
That is such a great point. It's about meeting the user where they are, which leads us to location and culture.
This is the really subtle stuff that trips people up. It's not just about translating English to Spanish. The sources mention cultural references.
Like using a thumbs up emoji? Is that a good example?
That's a perfect example. In the West, that means great job. In parts of the Middle East, that's a highly offensive gesture.
Right.
Or look at colors. In the West, white is for weddings. In some Eastern cultures, white is the color of mourning. If you design a celebratory website in pure white for that market, you are sending the completely wrong emotional signal.
And regarding gender, what do the sources say?
The source touches on this, noting that while, you know, neutral styles are often the safest bet, different genders can respond differently to certain design styles. It really just comes down to knowing exactly who you are talking to and verifying your assumptions, not just guessing.
It is wild to think about the entire journey a single message takes.
We should trace it.
Okay. So I sit down at my desktop computer because I need the keyboard input.
Good call.
I open a DTP application because I want a nice layout with frames.
Critical step.
I type the text. I add an image. I make sure to add the alt text for accessibility. I hit send. It travels via Ethernet from my desk to the wall. Then it hits the fiber optic network to cross the ocean. It jumps onto a 5G tower. Beams through the air.
And lands on a tablet in the living room in Tokyo.